All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Monday, February 2nd, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Monday. Sorry, I was trudging through the snowbanks to get here in the tundra. I'm just kidding. We got actually probably a couple feet of snow last night, and it was quite the surprise to everyone. We were not expecting it. I know we were kind of, but they had made all of the projections were supposed to be more toward the south of New York. Originally, they had shown down like at the PA New York line, and I laughed and said, ha ha ha, it won't be for us. But guess what? It was. So we have a winter wonderland today. Sorry, I missed my end of my bumper. That was my fault, but I had to get woolied up to get out here because damn, it's cold. So, all right, I hope everybody is recovering from the kitten bowl yesterday. We watched hours and hours of kittens running around on a fake football field playing with each other. Actually, it was adorably cute. And I was forced to at least ingest some of the Super Bowl, but you'll be proud to know that I was on the couch under a blanket with my eyes closed most of the time. I don't know. I really don't care for football. I used to when it was the Buffalo Bills and we had some chance in hell of winning, but that didn't happen four times in a row and we all pretty much gave up. So what we're going to start with today is a continuation of the last 2 weeks, but I dug up some pretty nifty stuff that I want to discuss with you. Hope everyone's got their thinking caps on and a couple cups of coffee in them because there's going to be some brain power that is required. So over the last 2 weeks, we looked at precision healthcare, something that Obama talked about as part of the State of the Union. We looked at the evil plan behind it, how Obamacare was designated not a healthcare plan back in November of 2013 by Kathleen Sebelius. And that then allows kickbacks, and we found the proof, kickbacks to be legal because it is no longer covered. Or is not at all covered under the anti-kickback statutes that currently cover Medicare and Medicaid. We also saw how Obama wants to use precision medicine to bring together your doctor, genetics, investors, federal regulators at all, and include them in your healthcare decisions. And of course, for the good of all, for the good of the collective, we shouldn't be expecting our healthcare information to be private because your healthcare information and the research that they do on you and the discoveries that they find could help others. So give it up, Buttercup. We also looked at the genetically modified mosquitoes, which is kind of funny, but originally when we were talking about them last week, I was talking about the incident 2 years ago where they wanted to release them in the Keys and people freaked out. Well, it just so happens that very same morning after we got off the air, I happened to find that there was a brand new story about those same exact genetically modified mosquitoes produced by a company named Oxitec out of the UK. The principals in that corporation happened to be former executives and R&D people from Syngenta slash AstraZeneca. So we have your genetically modified seeds and biopharma, big pharma companies making pharmaceutical drugs to test on you. We also looked at Ebola and the whole quote unquote Ebola panic and really what that did. I mean, now we have all these clinics that the military built in Africa, and some of them have never even been used. That's how bad that outbreak is. But what we did end up with here in this country is that the pharmaceutical companies have actually gone beyond just testing in the lab, and they moved, I believe it was six different trials now into humans. So, hey, that's where the money is, and that is the ball you should be paying attention to. So, what's so bad about vaccines? Well, we have the anti-vaxxers. That's the one other thing we were looking at. The measles virus outbreak. Holy shit. It's going to be the end of us all. I mean, come on, people. I know that most people don't get measles now, but I was even talking in college. I ended up with measles, and that was with my original vaccine that I received in the 60s or early 70s. I still managed to come down with a mild form of it. And I found something pretty interesting, which I don't know if anyone realizes, but when I think of measles, I think of red dots. But I found an article in one of my science magazines that actually gives you a breakdown of what measles actually does. And as I was reading this, I was remembering before Christmas. I was remembering that illness that I had, that upper respiratory flu thing that I even passed on to my cats mysteriously. Not one cat, but two. That just about everyone I knew also had the same thing. It was a really, really horrible upper respiratory plague, I called it. And the only place that I had really been that I could have caught it before Christmas had been the post office, ooh, which happens to be a federal facility. I was postulating this yesterday as I found the story. So listen to this. What does measles actually do? Now remember, too. So this measles outbreak, they're blaming it all on the anti-vaxxer parents. It supposedly happened, started at Disneyland in California. Oh my God. It is the Nirvana for children. Be afraid, be very afraid. Run and hide your kids. I now am seeing that there are parents coming out all over demanding that children without vaccinations be kept from school, demanding that they have the entire school vaccinated. Damn you. Because those anti-vaxxers, they are going to kill us all. This is now adding another shiv between us, divide and conquer. And especially when it comes to the safety of your children, you're going to be like a rabid raccoon. So they're hoping that this really ramps up. When the Ebola quote unquote outbreak happened, I had done a story in regards to that Carrie, I don't remember her name, the nurse. Or the Doctor Without Borders lady who got off in New Jersey and they had said she'd been exposed and they put her into quarantine. And I did a story on what your rights are while you're in quarantine and whether or not they can force vaccinate you. And what came out of that whole situation is that yes, they can put you into forced quarantine. And yes, with those additional executive orders that came out in July and that other one that we read about some of the newest communicable diseases that they are going to be able to quarantine for. I'm trying to remember when that was. Was that October, September, October? They included things like pneumonia in there where they could put you into quarantine. Civilian internee manuals had actually talked about you being a risk to the larger population. And if that is the case, they are able to force vaccinate. So check this out. We had the Super Bowl going on yesterday. And what headlines did I see? I saw, oh, will we be able to contain the measles outbreak before the Super Bowl? So it'll be very interesting to see now if all of a sudden we have 100,000 cases of measles and they're going to track it all back to the Super Bowl. I don't know, put on a seatbelt. But here, check this out. What do measles actually do? By the way, headline news on CNN right now is talking about commercials yesterday on the Super Bowl. So it must be really important. Okay, what does measles actually do? The United States is now experiencing what promises to be one of the worst outbreaks of measles. Of course it is. Since the virus was declared eliminated from the country in 2000, it began in early January at Disney Resort in Anaheim, California, and has since spread to 14 states and infected 84 people. Oh, the humanity. according to the CDC. You know, here, speaking of CDC, you know, right before the whole Ebola outbreak, we followed that pretty closely. The lack of chain of command when it comes to virulent pathogens not being properly contained at the CDC, sitting willy-nilly for 30 years on the tops of filing cabinets. So who's to say that this measles outbreak didn't come from some CDC vials that were maybe carried long distances by someone improperly in a Ziploc baggie? Just saying. Measles, caused by a paramyxovirus from the genus Morbillivirus, is one of the most contagious diseases in the world, infecting more than 90% of susceptible hosts that come in contact with an afflicted individual. Now, I want to remind you of that number, 90%. Now, remember when I talked about my cats getting sick from me? There were only a few times when I was a kid, twice that I can remember, out of 47 years of life, that I remember. And I mean, my cat, I love my kitties. I've had kitties my whole life. My kitties sleep with me. I don't know. Recently, I try to keep them out of my room just because the cat hair kills me. But I mean, growing up, my cats would sleep like literally on my face. They'd wrap themselves around my neck and snuggle with me at night. You know, I mean, I always live very closely with my animals. And only two times out of my whole youth do I remember my cats ever getting sick. And who knows if they ever got sick for me, but I mean, as a kid, I remember making that observation. This time I am positive. I mean, the symptoms were exactly the same. The whole upper respiratory and the runny eyes and the really, really super congested upper body. I know my cats caught what I had this time. So anyway, listen, they're now saying that measles infects 90% of all susceptible hosts. Well, okay, but measles is measles are dots. They're not upper respiratory. Well, think again. In the absence, this is back to the story, of a widespread vaccination, the average person with measles infects an average of 12 to 18 other people. In contrast, Ebola, interesting they mention Ebola in here, Ebola is typically transmitted to 1.5 to 2.5 people per infected person. So look at, they turned up the heat on the frog in the pot is what they did. They said, all right, Ebola was one. We could frighten them with images of hemorrhaging people that are never going to happen. But hey, we got to try all these experimental RNAi vaccines now. Be afraid, be very afraid. Now, measles, on the other hand, look at, now we can turn it on all those people who aren't getting vaccinated, who are throwing the alarm about the poisons in vaccines and make it look like it was their fault. And we can make it a much bigger outbreak. No one will be hemorrhaging out their ass. They'll just have some red dots and a cough. What? A cough? Yes, a cough. Listen. Although, so it's highly, highly transmissible, measles, but according to this, although the overall mortality rate for children who get measles is only 0.1 to 0.2%, so mortality rate is low, transmissibility is high. Unlike Ebola, transmissibility was low, but mortality rate was high. At one point, they were talking about 70%+. I think at the end, it only ended up being 40 or 50% when they averaged out all the numbers. But although the overall mortality rate for children who get measles is only between 0.1 and 0.2%, as many as one out of every 20 children will also develop what? Oh, yes, Obama mentioned this, pneumonia. Yes, yes. Now let's have a big outbreak of pneumonia. So we can exercise some of our new executive order laws for quarantine. The disease symptoms can be managed with anti-inflammatory drugs, hydration, and rest. Sorry, guys. It's cold and I'm still drinking my first cup. But like many other viral illnesses, there is no cure and antibiotics will have no effect. So what does measles do in the immune system? This is what I really wanted to point out to you. Listen, and we've talked about different ways that they've postulated to infect large areas of the population with different illnesses. And one of those was the zombie virus. If you remember back 3 or 4 years ago, I've talked multiple times about those three scientific studies I saw and like Discover, National Geographic, and Scientific American, maybe, where scientists were postulating how would we make a zombie virus that would spread rapidly. And I believe National Geographic was the one that won the Cupid doll, the mutated Cupid doll, for suggesting that they mix the cold virus with rabies. Well, listen to this, and then spray it aerosolized. What does measles do to the immune system? Well, measles virus is spread from person to person through the air in a coughed out aerosolized droplet that is inhaled. The virus typically first comes in contact with the host's lung tissue, where it infects immune cells called macrophages and dendritic cells, which serve as an early defense and warning system. From there, the infected cells migrate to, oh, where was the first sign and symptom when I had this quote-unquote flu plague at Christmas? My glands all swelled up. Yes, well, the measles virus goes from the lungs to the lymph nodes. And from there, they migrate throughout the body, releasing virus particles into the blood, the spleen, lymph nodes, liver, thymus, skin, and lungs are the eventual destinations for the virus. And in rare instances, the virus can cross the blood-brain barrier. Infection of lung cells causing a hacking cough keeps the virus circulating in the population. Now, along with that, of course, comes inflammation, which then causes the rash. But what I found extremely interesting is that the measles virus is spread aerosolly through people coughing, causes your lymph nodes to swell, and then causes a hacking cough. Now, how interesting that a large number of us ended up with a flu-ish thing that started out very, very similar to that right around Christmas time, that wouldn't go away, that took forever, that really whomped our immune system. And now we have this measles outbreak. All I'm saying, and I don't know if it was some mutated measles virus, who knows, but it seems very suspicious to me that how it started and how it was so transmissible, it passed to two, not one, but two of my cats. The one cat got over it quickly. The other one did not. She's fine now, though. It doesn't kill a lot of people, but it's highly transmissible. I'm telling you guys, I got the spidey sense thing that goes on sometimes. And the second I read that line describing the symptoms, red lights started to go off for me. This is test number two we are in the middle of right now. That's what it says to me. But hey, why the hell would they be doing shit like this? Well, if you follow the dots. So first, they convince you that the CDC isn't infallible. They make mistakes too, and they leave vials of dangerous stuff laying all over the place. And we saw probably 20 stories on that. And oh, once you see 20 stories, you're not afraid anymore. Because you know what? Even though they didn't have a good chain of command of all of these horrifying, debilitating diseases at one point, they must now. Because look, the CDC was so in control of things with the Ebola outbreak. No, they weren't really. But remember, they made you feel like they were because they told you that they formed an Ebola SWAT team, right? They tied the military right into dealing with outbreaks. Oh, yes, they did. Oh, what? They sent the military to Africa, where, of course, we had looked at a whole bunch of things with Africa. I'm not going to get into that, so we have time left over for me to move forward here. But we also sent military to Africa that had to go build all those clinics that are no longer being used because what? Oh, yes, they found the tree that all the infected fruit bats were in. They also passed laws as to what is considered a quarantinable offense because of Ebola. They also, because of all these new novel treatments that they had waiting in the wings mysteriously when Ebola, quote unquote, broke out, they also made the American public feel safe because science is in control. Yes, we had this new, quote unquote, serum that will cure you. Even though it didn't cure everyone, the first dude died, but it did cure some of them. And those people who were supposedly cured of this killer disease, I noticed that, you know, mainstream news, who's always scrubbing, digging, bottom feeding to get viewers, didn't jump all over all those wonder curies to have them on his interviews. It doesn't make any sense. It's like Obama. And we find out he was born in some hospital in Hawaii, and that hospital in Hawaii never stepped up and said, hey, the president was born here, with a big sign out front. Yeah, just like that. So they've now convinced the public that the medical establishment, the military industrial medical biopharma establishment that has been formed now over the last few months in the mind's eye is going to save you, right? That's what we like to hear. They're going to save us. Don't worry about it. Yeah, you saw it was horrible, but look how fast we fixed it, and you'll be all safe. All right. So now this measles thing happens, and oh my goodness, is the anti-vaxxers and mystery illnesses. Remember before all this, there was this mystery illness spreading everywhere that everyone was getting, and before that, they said it was the whooping cough. Maybe it's been some sort of bioengineered measles all along. Don't worry, because we'll come up with a cure. Well, all right, this is where the show begins now. This is where it all begins. So, I run across a story right after we get off air on Friday. Now, what have we been talking about? Well, part of these RNAi vaccinations that they've been working on and now testing in humans for the first time ever because an emergency was declared because of Ebola, contain things that have never been used, at least in widespread acknowledged testing in humans. Ethically speaking, they were only able to be allowed to be used in animals for testing unless there was a quote unquote emergency. Well, now the emergency was declared. They're doing testing in humans. Look at, nobody died yet that we know of. And some of the stuff that they are using in these vaccines, at least in the RNAi, are proteins. That's what your amino acids are. They're proteins, RNA, which then rewrites DNA. But also we discovered that in some of these vaccinations, they're also using nanotechnology. Now, one of the things that I don't know if I'm going to be able to dig, and maybe this will be tomorrow, where we actually dig into all that's going on in nanotechnology. But this story this interview, well, we'll go back to this story. This story from Friday, it's almost like one of my science publications was listening to the show, or I was channeling, something happened, because doesn't Google, who has Kurzweil, the crazy guy who wants to upload himself into the machine, and CEO Eric Schmidt, the dude that's working on one of the many immortality projects around the globe that ties together our federally funded public health, like the National Institute of Health, organizations, our universities, and corporate America, together with the Brain Project, They come out with a story in phys.org on Friday titled Google Eyes Nanoparticle Platform as Part of Health Rethink. Now, this comes on the heels of the announcement of precision medicine and everything we've been talking about. I've been telling you about the nanotech. We are going to spend, I think, the next week talking about nano and how it's actually been in our food. And they've been experimenting on us for at least 15, I'm going to say 20, but I have proof right now, 15 years. I have an interview, which some of you saw on Friday. I dropped it into chat after the show. Kurzweil actually interviews the father of nanotechnology, and we're going to listen to that maybe tomorrow. I don't know if we'll have time today. But I want to look at the story right now. Google Eyes nanoparticle platform as part of Health Rethink. This is the next step. Remember, it has now been established in the psyche of the American public with an attention span of about 4 minutes that science and medicine and technology are going to save us all. So don't worry about it. Go back to watching the Super Bowl. All right, I'm going to read this. Google likes taking on big problems, and that is no secret. Remember, DARPA's in the middle of all this. As is Motorola, Samsung, all the smart technology. This is no accident. Google likes taking on big health problems, and that is no secret. Transportation, communication, and now health. The Atlantic, which is a publication, has posted a video, and it is all about Google's attempt to redefine how we what? Oh, yes, manage our health. I don't know about you, but how do you feel about Google being in the middle of your healthcare? And it gets even worse than that. It's not just going to be your medical data. And there were quite a few years ago, I remember Google released something called Google Wallet or something like that, Google Health something. And they wanted you to go in, put all of your disorders, and then put all your medications in there. And they would give you alerts. And it would be some sort of portable. And this was when they were trying to get electronic health records kicked off. And there really was a low adoption rate at the mom and pop shop doctor's offices like we talked about last week, is because they didn't have an IT staff. It was one guy trying to be the doctor and the receptionist and the accountant trying to provide your health care. But Google, that didn't work out. People had privacy concerns and it kind of died. Well, Google quietly over the last 3 years has been building a cutting edge health facility, said Atlantic's magazine. Google's facility employs what? Over, yes, 100 doctors and scientists. James Hamblin, senior editor at The Atlantic, sat in the Mountain View, California location and spoke with Andrew Conrad, head of Google Life Sciences. I didn't know they had a Google Life Sciences division. That might be a really good one to do a little research on. Conrad, during the interview, told him that the group is trying to change medicine from being episodic and reactive, like going to the doctor because your arm hurts, to proactive. Now, guys, what did I tell you? The way that they are going to get you to line up for this new technology is to tell you that they came up with a cure for what? Probably something like cancer. And there's going to be a lot of the American public that are going to jump right on board, put themselves in front of the line to be some of the first that this wondrous new technology are going to cure. Remember, don't ever be 1.0. Well, here we go. Google is actually working on a wristband that can detect cancer cells when they first appear. I'm going to tell you, this is the way they sell it every single time. When we first started looking at some of this RNAi technology, that's what all the stories talked about as well. They're working on a wristband that can detect cancer cells when they first appear. That would be possible in a system where they would be designing tiny magnetic particles to patrol the human body for signs of cancer and other diseases. The director says, quote, so imagine that you swallow a pill. Didn't that Regina Duggan from DARPA say that, the one who worked for Google? So imagine that when you swallow a pill, and maybe you'd take this pill twice a month, and that pill has small things called nanoparticles in it. Yeah, well, that's already happening in the Gardasil vaccine. They're called virus-like particles that are loaded with nanoparticles. But this pill, so this is this imaginary cancer pill, has small little things called nanoparticles in it, decorated on their surface with markers that attach to cancer cells. We have them circulate all throughout your whole body, and then we collect them in the vasculature of the arm with a magnet, and we ask them what they saw. In brief, Google is designing a system where tiny magnetic particles patrol the human body for signs of cancers and other diseases. Brooks Hayes says that, quote, the pill would release nanoparticles into the patient's bloodstream. The magnetized particles would then tour the body, seeking out cancer cells to bind to, and a wearable monitor would attract and count the particles, pulling information as to what the particles had detected. Now, what's interesting is that this wearable monitor, they are stating, will probably, and let's talk about this, go on your wrist. If you've seen, there's two things. One of the projects that Google's been working on with Regina Duggan and Samsung and Motorola is the wearable smart technology, the watch that then tethers to all of your other smart devices in your house. What you'll also see is that there is a wristband, and I've seen it all over the last few months, and they are pushing it as a health tracker. You could wear it. It takes your pulse, your respiration rate, your oxygen rate, and you use it for exercising, and maybe it'll even tell you how many calories you burned. This has all been planned. See, people are used to that stuff now. It doesn't take long. Dumb Americans love gadgets because it's all buy, obey, and consume. So wearable monitors are nothing scary anymore. So now they just turn it up one more notch. Let's take a pill. Keep that smartwatch on that you have, and it'll tell us if you ever get cancer. All right, a wearable monitor attracts and counts particles, pulling information as to what particles it had detected. Cancer cells, for example, would light up. Well, how does light pass through the skin? To understand that, Google started making synthetic skin. We remember that from about a year or so ago. They've actually managed to make synthetic, and I don't know if it was just Google. It was a lot of different groups. DARPA was very involved in that. Remember, that was all in the name of curing our poor injured veterans. But Google started to make synthetic skin, and for their arm model, they had to use materials that behave like skin with biocomponents of real arms. Also, Google is monitoring 175 healthy volunteers, collecting psychological data frequently. The goal is to understand what defines a healthy person. And to know what normal is, they need to understand the baseline. All right. So there is a video that goes along with this. You got to give me just 1 second because I was not that on top of things to get myself already connected. And I hate to tell you, but I don't see a chat room open here. Let me check this other series of browsers. I don't think there is. So the good news is I don't think I'm going to feed back here with the stream playing. All right, let me find myself. Jules, there we go. Now, what are the chances? We've been talking about this for eons. And lo and behold, Friday, Google steps out and says, yes, we're going to come cure your cancer because Google's tagline is Google is not evil. Ha ha ha, with diabolical laughter. All right. So here is the head of this Google healthcare cutting-edge facility that they've quietly been developing for 3 years, interviewing with a reporter from The Atlantic. And I might fast forward here about 20 or 30 seconds until they really get into the meat and potatoes. Hold on.
Yeah, you can get real skin.
Let's talk about the procurement of real skin for a moment.
All right, yeah, see, we don't want to hear all the music and crap. All right, here we go.
You usually wear flip-flops, or that you often do, but not today.
No, it was cold today.
It is cold, and you have a cold.
I do.
You are the head of Google's Life Sciences Lab, and you are yourself not well. Why has no one cured the common cold yet?
I would rather cure cancer. I'll do the colds after cancer.
Because you know you're gonna get through the sniffles. It would be terrible to lose you to this. We'd have to go to Bing's Life Sciences Lab.
Yeah. The central thesis of what we're trying to do at Google Life Sciences is we're trying to change medicine from being episodic and reactive, like I go to the doctor when my arm hurts, to proactive and preventative.
So you have arms, and this is how you diagnose breast cancer.
What these arms are is the model systems in which we're trying to detect small particles that flow through the arm. So imagine that you swallow a pill, and that pill has small things called nanoparticles in it. Nanoparticles are very tiny particles, about 2,000 of them can fit inside a red blood cell, but they're decorated on their surface with markers that attach to cancer cells. We then have them circulate through your whole body looking for those cells, and we collect them in the superficial vasculature of the arm with a magnet, and you ask them what they saw.
And you would basically wear this like a Fitbit, and you would take a pill maybe twice a month that would make your red blood cells light up.
Hopefully it would make only the cancer cells light up. When they were casting and making these arms, they had to make them out of materials that behave like skin, have the same autofluorescence and biochemical components of real arms.
And you use some real skin at some points, right?
Human skin.
Do the people know that their skin is going onto the market?
Oh, yeah. Their skins can go for use in medical schools or other research programs.
You have to account for people of different ethnicities, different skin tones, different thicknesses of skin in the literal sense, because people will say sometimes that you have thick skin. That is a metaphor. But you...
That's what it means. It's important for us to understand how these nanoparticles and the perception of these nanoparticles perform with people with very different characteristics.
It's just like Breaking Bad.
You look a little crazy.
Help me out, Catherine.
So we are in one of the Google Life Sciences labs. You can point at anything you particularly like. It's a computer. So one of the things we realized at the beginning when we started this project was that we needed to have a better way of understanding what distinguishes a healthy person from an unhealthy person.
You need to know what normal is.
Exactly. We need to understand the baseline.
So could you potentially tell Jim if he was normal?
I think we already know that I'm normal. But if I did want to know if I was normal, what is the way that I could maybe check that out?
We're going to shine in laser, and then we're going to see the signal that is emitted from your skin.
Okay.
Okay, so this is zero.
Okay.
Right? Now we'll go back to our normal. And are you ready for the truth? So you're a little bit lower than normal.
What does that mean?
It means that he needs to spend more time in the sun.
Really?
Yes.
How far are we from a realistic implementation of this?
We're making good progress, but the journey is long and hard. So I think we will get there. And I hope it's years, not decades. A lot of medicine has become incremental, looking for a slightly better thing. And at Google X, the thesis is to try to do something that's, you know, logarithmically better. And I think that's alluring to people. I think it's curious for people to go, oh, okay, let me try to do something that's profoundly different.
We're in an area of reaction to potential invasions of privacy. Do people want to be monitored all the time? Do people say, it would be weird to have particles flowing through my body that are constantly tracking me?
Yeah, it's way weirder to have cancer cells floating through your body that are constantly trying to kill you.
That's a great answer.
Yeah. That's a great answer.
Yeah. That's very strong. Your magnet experiments are far beyond what I've been able to achieve in my apartment. This video is brought to you by Aetna. We have a YouTube channel.
Aetna, an insurance company. What do you think of that? So Google is looking to cure cancer. They're also developing self-driving cars. And what? Oh, they bought 8 robotics companies in the last year. Yeah, that should make you feel all warm and fuzzy. Keep using Google. I just couldn't even believe that story. If you give me a couple minutes, I don't have chat open right now, but maybe I can make it there quickly. Hold on. Oh, happy Monday. Buried under a couple feet of snow. Oh, if I can get there, I will drop you this link. Here it comes. I gotta turn that off. All right, here, we'll give you this. Yeah, so Google wants to cure cancer because they care about you. I just found this horrifying. It says, we want you to be able to go, just like a car that needs an oil change, we want you to be able to go to the mechanic when we are broken. They talked about the use of magnetic nanoparticles to monitor for signs of cancer and other diseases. They said it was to functionalize nanoparticles, the nexus between biology and, yes, engineering. So I found an interview. Well, actually, I found a whole bunch of things. I found something a few days ago that had talked about the fact that they were able to isolate certain parts of our DNA, our genetic code. And actually, we might need a bigger chunk of time to listen to this Kurzweil interview. But he, the father of nanotechnology, Eric Drexler, was talking about them being able to make DNA scaffolding with nanotechnology as well. But one of the things that I was reading about the other day is that they've already been able to come up with a library and a sort of barcoding system where they literally can scan each and every one of us and get a barcode of your basic DNA makeup. And they can get like a almost like a quick view of what your makeup is, what issues you have, what future diseases you might die from. I mean, you people really, I'm hoping that you see here where this is all leading. I know I sure do, and it's not a pretty picture. We have Michio Kaku coming out telling the world that the evolution of humanity is to merge with the machine. Here, we're going to let's actually listen to a little bit of this. This is Ray Kurzweil, who is now the head of engineering for Google, having an interview. And this is probably quite a few years ago because he looks quite a bit younger. But this is an interview with Eric Drexler, the father of nanotechnology. Eric actually states that they've been messing with this out of MIT since the 70s. He is the one who actually discovered nanotech. But here, I got this queued up at 8 minutes and 50 seconds. And I think this is where we're going to take it for the rest of the show. And then we'll hop back on here tomorrow. Here, check this out.
How do you see these two worlds interacting? I mean, what?
And this is the merging of biology and biotechnology that they're going to be talking about.
Can we learn lessons from biology? Can we actually use components from biology? Can we take biological systems like cells or ribosomes and modify them to create other nanomachines? What's the interaction between the biological world and what we're trying to create?
The most central interaction, from my point of view, is the use of the molecular machinery found in cells, programmable productive machinery, to make components. Your cells contain ribosomes, which are programmable machine tools. They take in RNA, which has information from DNA, that RNA tape, it's digital information, is used to direct the formation, the construction of protein molecules, which are little chunks of material that are about as strong and stiff as something like polycarbonate plastic or epoxy. And they're the building blocks for molecular machinery in the cell. So you have a molecular machine that can be controlled to make components for more molecular machines. What we're learning to do is to program this biological machinery to make components that fit together to make structures designed by scientists and engineers. At present, one of the most impressive technologies is called structural DNA nanotechnology, which uses DNA not as an information molecule, not as a genetic molecule, but as a structure. You have the double helix and you treat it as a cylindrical strut. They can be linked together by having strands cross over from one to another. And researchers have made structures on a scale of millions of atoms. I think, though, that we'll very rapidly find that the non-biological materials are, for engineering purposes, better. And at that point, biology will be more teaching us lessons and being an area of application. Early products I would expect to include a wide range of instruments that are useful for biomedical applications, for example.
I want to stop for a second, because did you hear what he actually said from when we first started this clip? He talked about the RNA and using the proteins and going in and being able to then modify the DNA. And they're going to eventually be using biology to teach them how to do synthetic biology. But guys, this is what they're doing with those RNAi vaccines. This is how it all ties together. This is the grand experiment, the video that came out back a few months ago talking about how we're going to be a new version of human in the next 20 years. It's happening right now. This is all a big smokescreen. All of these fear-based, trauma-based mind controls to get us to buy into this stuff. Be afraid, be very afraid that there's going to be an outbreak. There's going to be whatever. Give up your privacy. Give up your body to science. That's what this is all about. That statement, the last minute that he just talked about, that's the key to it all. All right, I'm going to continue.
You've talked about the interplay between nanotechnology and artificial intelligence, and which might come first, and which, and how one might help the other. Can you comment on the interplay between these two revolutions?
It's certainly possible to develop nanotechnology, advanced nanotechnologies, without AI. On the other hand, if you have advanced nanotechnologies, they will give enormously more computational power, which should be an aid to developing AI. And if you had advanced AI, it would be something that could be a great aid to design and therefore would facilitate progress in nanotechnology. So neither one is necessary to the other. Either one can help the other.
A few decades ago, there was a conference, the Sillimar Conference, that established some ethical guidelines to keep genetic technology, the idea of biologically modifying viruses, safe. And they've actually worked very well for three decades now. What role do you see ethical standards playing in nanotechnology, and what do you see as the key sort of safety issues to keep this very powerful technology safe?
Looking at terrorism, I think the first thing to observe is this is a very sophisticated technology that will be in the hands of governments, corporations, long before it's in the hands of people who are in smaller groups and are outside the sphere of open technology development and activity. At some point, though, powerful technologies, as we've seen, tend to become widely available. And there are often things that can be done with them that one very much wants to suppress. And I think that if we look at the future, where technologies are going, even without nanotechnology, just with Moore's Law progress, we're seeing a greater and greater density of sensors and communication systems. I think that the concern that people should have downstream a decade or two isn't that there will be terrorists doing things that threaten them, but rather that systems that have been put in place to, among other things, suppress terrorism will have succeeded and may be used to suppress things that they would prefer not be suppressed. So people have been saying that terrorism will be a long, open-ended war. If you look at this from the perspective of technology, I think that even without nanotechnology, that we're moving toward a world of intensive network surveillance systems that will be able to suppress whatever people want to suppress. Terrorism is very much a passing problem, and that our concerns should be focused on how to manage the technologies that will make terrorism no longer be a problem, how to deal with a world in which there is that degree of ability to observe what people are doing and to control human action.
Guys, this dude is one hell of a smart cookie, okay? He is the father of nanotechnology, and he's telling us terrorism is a fleeting thing. It's what brought in this technology to be able to surveil us. I mean, it's what we've been saying. And we should be more concerned about the technology surveilling us and what that means as an end result of us never being able to put out information because they can suppress whatever they want to suppress with the technology rather than the technology or rather than what's going on in our environment that keeps us afraid.
One answer to the question of why people should develop nanofactories is that at some point it will be so easy that it will be the obvious thing to do. People right now are developing increasingly sophisticated nanotechnologies because, well, there's interesting science in developing some of the components, and there are practical applications. Every step is a step in increasing the control of the structure of matter. That's been sort of the story of much of technology for a long time. So progress in this general direction is a natural, spontaneous unfolding of technological advance in a worldwide sense. Another facet is taking the Moore's Law progress further than can be done with semiconductor processing. Another facet is looking at the cost reductions that we expect to see from these technologies and the very small resource requirements and the ease of providing power using solar cells that can be made with the same technology. This will provide a basis for taking everyone in the world, people who are dirt poor today, and providing them with a standard of living that's far beyond what we have in the developed world today and with less ecological impact.
Yes, and that is the promise, and this is how they're selling it. It's going to make it a better world for all of us. But remember, it all comes down to who is manipulating the controls. And if history is any type of lesson to us, you don't trust the psychopath with the wheel and the gas pedal. All right, we are almost out of time. So I want to read one more story that I caught again on Friday after I got off the air. This actually came out of Yahoo News, so I was surprised that it made such mainstream. It was titled, "Privacy is Dead, Harvard Professors Tell Davos Forum." Davos is the gathering they have every year of the rich people who talk about how we're going to control the world. So here we go. Davos, Switzerland. Remember, we talked about the mosquitoes. Davos, Switzerland, imagine a world where a mosquito-sized robot flies around and steals samples of your DNA. Or where a department store knows from your buying habits that you're pregnant even before your family does. That is the terrifying dystopian world portrayed by a group of Harvard professors at the World Economic Forum in Davos on Thursday, where the assembled elite heard that the notion of individual privacy is effectively dead. We watched that video too. Someone in chat had dropped that with a private investigator. It's been dead for a long time, and now anonymity is dead as well. Welcome to today. We are already at that world, said Margot Seltzer, a professor in computer science at Harvard University. Remember, Harvard is also where the whole Weiss Institute is, where they are developing robo bees and the mini mosquitoes, unmanned aerial micro vehicles. All right, back to the story. Another Harvard researcher into genetics said it was, quote unquote, inevitable that one person's genetic information would enter more and more into the public sphere. Sophia Ruth said intelligence agents were already asked to collect genetic information on foreign leaders to determine things like susceptibility to disease and life expectancy. We are at a dawn of the age of genetic McCarthyism, she said, referring to witch hunts against communists in 1950s America. What's more, Seltzer imagined a world in which tiny robot drones flew around the size of mosquitoes, extracting a sample of your DNA for analysis by, say, the government or an insurance firm. Invasions of privacy are, quote, going to become more pervasive, she predicted. Now, what's interesting is that she's not predicting this because she works for Harvard. Harvard is where the project for the RoboBees is happening, okay? This isn't a prediction that's pie in the sky future. This is something that's being worked on now. And she even says, quote, it is not whether this is going to happen. It's already happening, she says. And guys, I got 10 seconds left. Holy crap. All right. Make sure you guys stick around. We got new shows tonight. It is Monday. Up next, Mr. Hal Anthony. We have Boca Loco. We got Truth on the Tracks with Brandon Turberville. Anti-Media Radio with Nick and DB tonight. We're going to continue. This whole week is going to be Nanotech Week. All right, guys. Hope all of you on the East Coast are digging out. Everybody have an awesome Monday, and I will catch up with you tomorrow.